With tech, the devil's in the details sometimes, many times. People need to know that for whatever dystopia they're offering you, there's usually a much better way of doing that very same thing.
What's the future we're headed towards, you know, in terms of big tech control? What's the alternative?
The road that we're currently headed down is rather bleak to my view, because as we've experienced with this podcast, and as I've seen by using big tech platforms, especially social platforms, the road that they're headed down is AI-based mind control. That's really what they're doing, is they have figured that they can use AI to automate censorship on a very granular level. They basically tell the AI, because now every video on YouTube, for example, is transcribed, right?
Yeah, automatically.
Automatically. So you can take that transcription of what people are talking about in the episode, such as ours, and feed that through an AI, and then tell the AI, hey, if these guys are talking about this subject or that subject or that subject, I want you to just output, you know, an X or whatever, and flag this, and then our algorithm will suppress their video. So then they can just kind of like sit back, relax, and like, our matrix is working. We have total power and control over all of the YouTubers. They can't do anything to fight with our little AI gremlin. So that's the road that they're headed down. Now, the alternative to that are, and there are many alternatives to that, or platforms that are against that type of censorship and that are interested in novel and new decentralized technologies. So one of the biggest alternatives to YouTube, for example, that I like to promote is Odyssey, because Odyssey is a team that's not just creating, like, they want to create YouTube in its early days, the kind of feel that YouTube had back when it first started, when like you could upload almost anything.
Dramatic chipmunk days, right?
Yeah. And it was much more egalitarian.
Yeah.
Not only are they approaching it from that perspective, because there are other platforms that are doing that too, like, for example, BitChute and Rumble. But the reason why I promote Odyssey specifically is because that is a team that's also interested in actually taking advantage of decentralized technologies for storing the videos themselves. And that's what I would love to see more of, is video hosting platforms that use decentralized technologies, because decentralized technologies are more dependable, reliable, and neutral technologies. So if a video hosting platform like Odyssey is looking into a platform like Arweave for hosting its videos, I think that's a very positive sign. So that's a platform that I would encourage people to upload their videos to. And they don't need to completely switch over to it. But what they can do, like, one of the things that we've started doing is, of course, we upload our videos to both Odyssey and to YouTube. But because we know that YouTube isn't always going to show our videos to viewers, we have started, actually, when we announce the videos on our social, on our socials, we link to the Odyssey video first. So we prioritize Odyssey over YouTube. And that's something that I encourage other people to start experimenting with. And what we've seen is that we've actually seen that Odyssey can, in many instances, meet or exceed the view count of YouTube, especially on videos that YouTube is suppressing, right? So this is a kind of a, we're all in this together movement, where it's like, hey guys, we're in this boat. They're trying to steer the boat in this bleak direction. We all got to work together to slowly turn it in this other brighter future.
Even the big creators on YouTube, the ones who, you know, have monetized their channels, have made a lot of money on YouTube, almost all of them complain about the YouTube algorithm and having to keep up with this thing that changes every day, because the way that YouTube is structured is, you know, if you're at home and you open YouTube, you're probably not putting in the search bar what you're looking for. You're getting a feed that the algorithm has given you, and you're choosing from, you know, the thing it's selected for you, right? And the thing about, like, we're talking about how we're getting shadow banned with this. And it's not even that they have to take our video off of YouTube or actively do anything. They're just gonna be like, okay, we're gonna take your nice video, but we'll just put it in the corner over here, right?
Yeah.
You know?
Yeah, this is what they call freedom of speech, not freedom of reach.
Right. Yeah. I think that's a great way to explain it, right?
Yeah.
And so what does Odyssey do differently? What's the different experience on Odyssey than it is on YouTube?
So Odyssey does a few things differently. One is that they don't seem to put as much effort into curating their algorithm and what is and isn't allowed on the platform. So they are very vocally pro free speech. Now, of course, they do censor illegal content.
Yeah.
So that makes sense. And one of the other things that they do at the moment, and I think that this might change, is that they were using some token based on this blockchain called Library. And they had this Library token, and you could stake it on a video to promote the viewership of the video a little bit. So it kind of impacts its reach, and maybe like the likelihood that it'll make it to the front page or something like that is slightly impacted by how much you stake. I don't know the details of this, but they're also planning on converting or either like moving off of that Library token onto Arweave, which has its own token. And there's all those mechanics. I'm just excited about the fact that they're considering a decentralized technology for storing the videos, because mm-hmm. that's going to allow them to compete a lot more with YouTube to begin with fewer resources. So by using a decentralized technology, it lowers their costs for actually hosting the videos.
How does it lower their costs? What's the difference?
Well, because there isn't this one company that's managing a data center that you have to pay for the cost of storing all of the videos. Instead, what you have is a community of people, of volunteers, who are holding this token, the Arweave token, and they're offering their storage capacity. You might just have, for example, like, you know, some spare hard drives mm-hmm. in your lying around in your room that aren't doing anything, but you could be making money off of those by plugging in your computer to the wall and running Arweave on it, and then having the network store information on your computer. And so there's this vast potential when you take this decentralized approach. And you start thinking about, well, how do I empower more people, not just me, which is like the mentality of these big tech companies. They have the ability to lower costs because there's a massive supply of unused hard drives that mm-hmm. people have and that they're interested into converting into money. And so that helps lower the costs for Odyssey as well, because they can then store their videos on there for fairly cheap comparatively. And I think that's really cool.
So we're looking at the future of, you know, we're looking at these two possible futures, right? Mm-hmm. And so we're talking about this in the context of, this is what your, you know, your video streaming platform, your free video streaming platform might look like. You can be involved in helping host it. You don't have to be dependent on an algorithm that's going to feed your stuff to people or not based on the content, right? What about in like other spheres of the internet? What do those two futures look like?
Which other spheres are you thinking of?
I'll let you kind of take your pick.
Okay, but let's take social media.
Yeah, let's go social media. Great.
Social media is slowly being conquered by this dystopian AI matrix system. You know, it started with Facebook, which was basically, you know, ground zero for the AI matrix system. And then it started spreading to other platforms as well. And many of them started getting bought up by the same entities. You had, you know, Instagram appear, and then, oh, Meta comes along, buys mm-hmm. it, enters the AI matrix system. And you've got, you know, TikTok as well appeared, and then they also got bought out. And now they're entering the same system. So this is a mind control system is what this really is. And America is all about freedom of speech. So America, that's the First Amendment mm-hmm. To our Constitution. And this is important for many reasons, because if you do not even have the option of seeing what people are saying, like obviously people can say some horrible things, some things that aren't true, they can spread disinformation. This is not good. But if you are saying that, well, you know, it's kind of a trade-off. It's like, are you going to allow this disinformation to appear, or are you going to say that there's only one point of view that's allowed, and that is, you know, whatever orthodoxy of the day happens to be? It's kind of like a dark ages mentality, basically. Mm-hmm. It's definitely a way of holding back people, because inevitably, whatever that viewpoint ends up being, it ends up being wrong in some way or form, right? And somebody who's shouting out here, you know, some very important thing that can help humanity go forward into a bright future is being silenced. Yeah. That's not a good thing. So we do have to deal with disinformation. But really, I think the best way to deal with disinformation is through the discernment and education of the individual. Like we need to create and encourage individuals to become critical thinkers and to be able to navigate the sea of information, misinformation, and think for themselves. And that is the kind of future that I vote for personally, mm-hmm. and I promote. So getting back to the question of social media, you know, that's all about that sea of information and disinformation is social media. What we see is that most big tech social media platforms, with the possible exception of X, and even that is under siege right now and isn't providing a perfect, you know, kind of free speech zone. Most of them have been taken over by the AI matrix system that's moderated by not just humans now, but also by AI. And the alternative to that is, again, decentralization, decentralized systems. You have to figure out a way to decentralize the control of these systems and do social media in a more decentralized way. And that brings us to platforms like the Fediverse. They include software and platforms such as Mastodon that more people have probably have heard of.
Yeah, I think when Elon Musk bought Twitter, Mastodon had a big moment where everybody was talking about, oh, the move to Mastodon, right?
Right. Yeah.
So and of course, Meta tried to get in and be like, come on over to Threads.
That's right. Meta. Yes. In fact, there are two big entities. One of them was Mark Zuckerberg and the other one was Donald Trump.
That's right. Yes. Yeah.
So Meta came and they took Mastodon and they created Threads or something. It basically took this work that this guy had done on Mastodon and created this other social network that was kind of like Twitter. But then what they did, of course, and I don't know if this is still the case, but I think it probably is. They disconnected it from the Fediverse. So that, in other words, they removed it from the Federation. They were like, we're going to be in. And Donald Trump did the same thing with Truth Social. He took Mastodon, rebranded it, made some modifications to it, and disconnected it from the Fediverse.
I didn't know that both of those were built on Mastodon originally.
Now, I may be wrong about Threads, but no, Truth Social was built on Mastodon.
Wow.
Threads, I'm not so sure about. So somebody will have to double check on that.
You know, even if we're wrong, the controversy is good for the engagement, so don't worry.
Yeah. So, and that's not a good thing, because what we want is, again, we want to step away from this mentality of thinking of like these winner take all centralized platforms, because that's really more like a we all lose kind of a scenario. It's not really winner take all. It's a all end up losing situation, including the people who own those platforms, too, because they end up miserable as well. And it's certainly a headache when you're in charge of such a massive point of control, and then like everybody's yelling at you.
Yes.
This is what ends up happening with that, because you're responsible for everything.
Yeah, that's true. Everybody hates you.
Everybody hates you. Yeah. Who wants that?
This is your out, guys. You can.
Do you not want to snout here?
Yeah.
Yeah. Yeah. So there's the Fediverse, and then there are other decentralized social networks that are coming online, like I mentioned Nostr as well. And, you know, I could go into the technical details of what make these, and there's also Blue Sky, but it's not as decentralized as those other two that I mentioned. Mm-hmm.
While we're talking about dark futures, okay, I want to talk about Palantir a bit.
Oh, boy.
Okay. So let's open this can of worms.
Yeah.
People may have heard of Palantir. It's making the news a little bit lately. But what is Palantir? Other than being the thing from The Lord of the Rings, the orb that you use to, you know, talk to Sauron or something.
Yeah. Yeah. The eye, the all-seeing eye. Yeah. Yeah. So that is where they got their name from.
It's a little on the nose.
It's very on the nose. Yeah. And it is as far as I understand, now I haven't like done in-depth research into Palantir, but I've done cursory research into Palantir. And it is a project by Peter Thiel. And it is that he worked with, I believe, if I recall correctly, as a company that offered services to various different government agencies, including maybe the CIA, to make it easier for them to plug in databases of information about various different individuals and then create connections between those individuals so that you could use this software to ask questions about real world social networks and then figure out who's connected to who and whatnot, and then make various decisions, strategic government level decisions based on that information. And lately it's been in the news because it's being, you know, they may have expanded their product and their offerings and whatnot that they're doing. But lately it's, you know, a lot of people are seeing it in the news as being used more and more with various different governments and potentially being used as part of this alternative control grid to what China has. So back to the control grid, basically. They're viewing it as potentially a way of maybe implementing some part of the control grid. Now, I don't know the details on all of that. You know, I don't have access to Palantir. I don't use Palantir. But that's sort of what Palantir is about.
And they're also doing this project. They're doing a universal ID project, too.
You're talking about that cryptocurrency WorldCoin.
Oh, I'm sorry. It's WorldCoin that you're thinking of.
I am also familiar with a different orb-related thing, which is WorldCoin. And they also created these orb devices. And people were also actually lining up. Some people in some places were lining up for these things.
They had one in San Francisco you could go to.
To have their iris scanned, specifically. Not necessarily their face, but their iris. Because their iris...
We're living in the future, Greg. We're getting iris scans.
Yeah. So that... they can be given a little receipt that they could use then to prove their identity to then mint these world coins, basically. And that would be their ticket to owning WorldCoin. So we actually wrote a blog post about this. We even released a music video about this. And the issue with this is that, like, WorldCoin is about... a part of it, I think, is about creating a basic income, which I'm also an advocate of. But I'm an advocate... for doing basic income in a more private, privacy-respecting way. And that's what group income is all about. But with any basic income system, you need to be able to identify individuals to fight the Sybil attack, where somebody creates many identities and collects multiple income streams. You know, if you don't do that, your basic income system will succumb to fraud. So that's why they were scanning people's irises. But it's not, you know, the best way to... It's not a private way, because once they start using the currency, they can then add on the identifier back to that person. So initially, it's actually could be genuinely anonymous. But then once they start using it and interacting with it, then their address can become associated with their identity. And from that point on, it's no longer anonymous.
Yeah.
So that's one issue. It's not private. Then another issue with it is that it's not very good at fighting the Sybil attack either, because, you know, one person can get one of these machines, scan a whole bunch of viruses, collect all the receipts for themselves, and now they have many income streams. And, it's hard to prove that they're doing that. Any system that, you know, is gathering biometric data on people, whether it's scanning their iris or their face or whatever, that's to be able to identify them. And then they want to be able to maintain that identity and then use it for various different online services. And that could, again, tie into the control grid and whatnot. Now, there are other ways of going about meeting, because it's not all doom and gloom, right? There are legitimate use cases for needing to know somebody's identity.
Yeah, definitely. Yeah.
There, like, you may... want, for example, to identify somebody because you're distributing a basic income. That's one example of a legitimate need to identify people. But then there are other instances where, for example, you don't really need to know who they are. You just need to know something about them. So this would be the club with a bouncer who wants to make sure that you're over 21, right? Now, you don't need to use these dystopian identity systems to do that. You don't need to tell the bouncer exactly who you are, and you don't need to tell the government that you went to this club, right? You don't need to do that. And there are other groups who are working on identity systems that allow you to selectively disclose your information about yourself in a more private way. And some of them use the term self-sovereign identity. And other terms to watch out for and look for are verifiable credentials. And so there are some systems that are using these more privacy-respecting systems. And you, of course, not all of them will be privacy-respecting. Some, you know, you could look at a verifiable credential system and find out that, oh, actually, they're violating your privacy. So I'm not saying that, like, the word verifiable credential means privacy, okay? I want to be clear on that. But some of them are more private. Some of them are using actual... strong cryptography and whatnot, in ways of proving that, hey, this government issued you a credential that says that this is your birth date, or here's a credential or, you know, token or system that you can use to not even to give out your birth date, but just prove that you're over 21, or for example, prove that you have a license to drive this vehicle and whatnot. So with tech, the devil's in the details sometimes, many times. People need to know that for whatever dystopia they're offering you, there's usually a much better way of doing that very same thing.
Okay, so we were just talking about scanning your eyeball with an orb and biometric logins, and it made me think of something I do every day, which is I pick up my phone and I use my thumb to unlock my phone. Should I be worried about this?
Yes.
So no.
Yeah, it's not really recommended to use your biometrics as a way to unlock your phone, because it has been ruled in various courts at different points in time that these kinds of biometrics don't count as giving you protection from being forced or compelled to unlock your phone. So whether you're using Face ID or whether you're using your thumbprint, that's not a very secure way of unlocking your phone if that's a concern for you. So it would be better for you to use an actual secret that only you know that you have to enter manually to unlock your phone, which doesn't mean that you can't use the fingerprint as like a secondary form of authentication for like lower level stuff. Maybe like some apps sometimes employ the fingerprint sensor to open the app or whatever. But to unlock your phone, you probably shouldn't use any kind of biometrics.
Okay, that's good to know. I feel like that is the way that people do it now. And I just didn't even register that I might be doing something that's maybe not optimal. I thought for a second maybe they're like stealing my thumbprint or something when I put it in, but it seems like that's not what's happening.
Yeah, I mean, that's not really the concern. And technically, yes, it's possible to steal your thumbprint when you put it on your phone anywhere. And it's not that the sensor is stealing it from you. It's that you're leaving oils on the surface of the phone itself. And if somebody grabs your phone, you know, they could actually do that, like the techno stuff of like putting some powder on it, whatever, and creating a latex thing from Mission Impossible.
It was a little funny. I do look at my phone and I can literally see my thumbprint on the screen of the phone right here. But as long as I don't get Mission Impossible,
it'll be okay. And I mean, and they would only want your thumbprint usually in those Mission Impossible scenarios, like to unlock some door that also uses a thumbprint thing.
Yeah.
And, you know, the door should also probably not be using the biometric also.
And anyway, they're just going to go in through the vents so that Tom Cruise can, do something, do something athletic and maybe crazy.
Yeah.
Greg is going to tank the thumbprint door market.
Yeah. They're coming after you, Greg. Oh, man. Yeah. I think that's part of the reason why we're here talking about this stuff, is that it can be really hard to navigate all this, you know, things with tech. And it's really easy to go with the name, you know, the default choice or whatever. If I'm, you know, if I want to just generally be more cognizant about protecting my privacy online, what's a good resource for me to just look at?
The OK Turtles Foundation does run a blog, so you could follow our blog. You can also follow us on Odyssey, preferably, and also on YouTube. Definitely hit that bell, because if you don't, you're probably not going to see our videos. And even if you hit the bell, you still might not see our videos. So, but then there are other YouTubers who are also on Odyssey that I recommend. One of them is Naomi. Naomi Brockwell. And her, I don't remember the name of her channel, but it might just be Naomi Brockwell. Search her name. She does a fantastic series of videos on solutions, on technical solutions, and how different companies, different organizations are creating software that actually does preserve your privacy. And she recommends a lot of these interviews, a lot of the developers, promotes a lot of the tech. So I highly recommend the stuff that she puts out.
And I think that one of the instincts that we get when we hear about all these companies stealing our data and stuff, and maybe the difficulty of navigating good options out there, is like, oh man, I just want to disappear. Like, I don't want to have a presence online. Is it possible just to disappear from the internet?
Some people really try. Like, yeah. I have seen, but you know, these days it takes more effort, it seems, if you want to interact with most of society, because most of society uses these big tech systems. It's really hard to avoid these technologies, because to do that, you have to avoid society, period. So if you want to avoid these systems, yes, there is a way, and that is to go into the middle of nowhere. And even that isn't a guarantee, but you know, that is one way to minimize, you know, lots of, there's a big homesteading movement. There's a movement for people who want to become more and more self-sufficient and self-reliant, running, you know, buying property, creating their own off-grid systems and whatnot. That's kind of like, you know, taking off as well. And that is a way of doing things. But at the end of the day, this is a planet full of a lot of people, and you're going to have neighbors, and we all got to get along together. Mm-hmm. And I think that it's important for people to persuade one another and to learn about the options and choices that they face, and to choose the technologies that empower the most amount of people, as opposed to concentrating that power in the hands of the few, where it will almost always end up being abused.
And if I'm now just, I'm convinced, getting serious about taking care of my data privacy, what's the first few steps I should take in my online life?
One is very simple, which is use an ad blocker. And there are two good ones. One is called uBlock Origin. Mm-hmm. Another one is like a browser like Brave, which comes with a built-in one. And the company in general is very privacy conscious, and that's kind of one of their selling points.
And Brave works great. You converted me to Brave, and I've been really enjoying it.
Another one is consider using a VoIP number as your main number. There are some companies who you can buy, you know, use their service to buy VoIP numbers. And you can even have multiple ones so that you could, you know, segregate your identity. Like, these people get this number, that mm-hmm. person gets that number. And then use that, and don't use the actual number that, you know, the company, your cell phone company gave you. That's another thing you could do. You can also embrace more private communications technologies for when you're communicating with people. So things like, you know, Delta Chat or Signal or Group Income, for example. There's a whole bunch. There's a whole world of private communication software. Just make the conscious choice to slowly start shifting more and more of your communications into end-to-end encrypted messengers and end-to-end encrypted software.
There's something with Google wanting to do an age verification, right? Like, which makes sense. We want to protect minors on the internet. You know, there's certain content that we probably just never want to show to minors. But what is going on with this YouTube age restriction, and why is it something that is maybe not being implemented in a way that is in our best interests?
Yeah, so Naomi Brockwell actually talks a lot about this same question, and she probably will do a much better job than me, so I recommend going and watching some of her videos on this question. But the basic idea is that it seems like YouTube decided, for whatever reason, that its AI wizardry would identify some accounts that it would then enforce an age check on. And in order to pass this age check, like, so far I've managed to escape it. I don't know how, but like, they've they will then ask you for a lot more private information to prove that, you know, whatever your age is. But in doing so, you're also de-anonymizing yourself to YouTube. Mm-hmm. And now, instead of having this private semi-anonymous account that you could use to watch videos without having the system, you know, tracking what you're viewing and, you know, and all this other stuff, now you're exposing yourself to the AI control grid. So that's not good. That's why people are kind of pushing back against this. And not only for that reason, but also because they see this as a stepping stone for all other big tech platforms to potentially removing anonymity entirely. And that would also not be good, because if you completely remove the ability for people to be anonymous online, and that will only happen if people choose to use big tech platforms over other ones, then suddenly you have a really suffocated society where actual real points of view are not allowed to be expressed, and it's just propaganda 24/7.
So speaking of upsetting people online, we've posted some videos from this series, and the reason why you at home are maybe not watching this video right now is because we've been getting shadow banned.
Yes, and it's actually been a very interesting shadow ban. It's this AI matrix thing going on where some of our shorts are being promoted by the algorithm, and they're getting like over 1,000 views. And then other shorts that talk about other things are getting like close to zero views. So, and like any of the views that they actually have are most likely from, you know, our own team looking at them. Mm-hmm. So that's how we know that it's the algorithm at work here and not just because people aren't interested in it, because there's such a like several orders of magnitude disparity in view count. And we've verified this even further by doing little fun experiments with this one video that YouTube doesn't want you to see on our shorts page, where we've posted it several times. And each time we modify it a little bit slightly to see if maybe, you know, maybe the original video was like flagged for some reason. And then maybe that video, when you re-upload it again, they do like a simple checksum on it, and then, you know, that exact video won't be shown. But what we've done is we've actually modified the video. We changed the music, we changed the cropping on it a little bit, and we've changed the title, we messed with it, the description, and we re-uploaded it. In that sense, still zero views. And you know, we did this with like different parameters. And each time that video is not promoted by the algorithm. So that leads me to the, I think, a reasonable conclusion that it's not necessarily the title of the video. It's not necessarily that the video was specifically tagged, that specific file was tagged, but it's actually the spoken content in that mm-hmm. video is something that YouTube does not want you to see. And, you know, this video may well have the same thing happen to it, but I'm not going to tell you what's in that short. Okay. So you can go see that short. We just go to our YouTube page, go to the shorts and you'll see the video that I'm talking about and what they don't want you to know.
So there was a change in the way the YouTube algorithm worked in August, where it actually would stop showing you videos even from people you're subscribed to, right? And not all, maybe not all their videos, but some videos the algorithm would just withhold, where it kind of, YouTube taught you to come to their main page and it would always show you the new videos from all the channels that you're subscribed to that you watch regularly. But it implemented a new AI feature, right? So what happened there and what are the consequences?
So I can't claim to know exactly what YouTube did, but this sounds very similar to what we experienced with these shorts, mm-hmm. where if they're adding the AI to the algorithm, the only reason why they would be doing that is because they've trained this AI to promote certain topics and suppress other topics. And so if, and this is a very, again, this is like super granular level of controls and manipulation of like where it, the algorithm is automated to suppress very specific subjects and topics and whatnot while promoting others. And so if those YouTubers happen to be saying certain, you know, it's not even like about keyword when you're talking about AI, it's no longer even about keywords at this point. Mm-hmm. So one of the ways that in censorship regimes like, you know, China and whatnot, that people have resorted to getting around the censors is they would change the language that they would use subtly, right? Mm-hmm. Where they would either use an emoji or they would like invent a new word and everybody knew that this is what you were talking about, right? Well, now with AI-based censorship, that's not enough to get around the censorship anymore, because the AI can sort of kind of like figure out what you're talking about, and it can be like, okay, we think you're talking about this that they told us, you know, to suppress, so we're going to suppress you. Yeah. So that becomes a lot more difficult for people to deal with in terms of trying to talk their way out of censorship. Mm-hmm. And the solution to that is to just say goodbye to all these big tech companies and embrace the hardworking engineers who have been working on creating alternatives. So things like Odyssey, things like, really, I'm just going to say Odyssey, to be honest, because I want, like, it's... I definitely support and promote alternative platforms, whether they're Rumble or whether they're BitChute or whether even like more novel hosting platforms. But it's important to actually compete with big tech. Mm-hmm. And to compete with big tech, you can't splinter the population across too many.
There needs to be
kind of like a go-to. Yeah. Like the public kind of has to vote and say, YouTube, we rebuke you. we do not like what you're doing, and we don't like it if anybody does this to us. Stop messing with our speech. Let us say what we want, and we're going to use this other platform that does. And so we're all going to go there now.
And what's kind of cool about this is that ultimately we do have the power to do that. YouTube is completely dependent on people creating content of their own free will yeah. and putting it on the platform, and then people consuming that content.
That's right.
But I mean, it gives, even though all these creators are kind of at the whim of the YouTube algorithm in so many ways, they also have the power to say, hey, my audience, I'm going to Odyssey. Follow me there if you want to see my videos.
Exactly.
Right? And it's kind of cool because it can happen. Like sometimes big tech control seems so impossible to take over, you know, because it's these giant companies with, you know, just untold amounts of money and influence.
Yeah. And that is why I think that they're starting to take this more granular AI-based, censorship-based approach to censoring, because they see that when they're doing more heavy-handed censorship and they're just banning entire channels outright, mm-hmm. that it's really hurting their own platform and their own sort of their own public image, and it's driving more and more creators away to these other platforms. But this other form of censorship is even more insidious. And if creators don't want to put up with this, and I don't think they should, there's this exit that they have, and I recommend they take it.
Why can't we just like fix YouTube?
YouTube could potentially be reformed, but I think that it's unlikely to happen. And even if it were to be reformed, I mean, it would really require a massive change to the incentives that the leadership has. Mm-hmm. And it's sometimes these things take on an inertia where it's really hard to do an about face like that. Mm-hmm. So there's also something to a kind of a public punishment kind of a thing where, you know, YouTube that has really been put into the position that it's in by the people can then be kind of rejected by those same people who can then say, hey, we're not putting up with what you're doing. We think you need a timeout. We're going and taking our videos and we're going to this other platform.
What is your thoughts on AI and having it make decisions in so many different things that maybe it's not ready for?
Other people on YouTube have been complaining about the AI or the algorithm. You know, it's not always clear what is actually suppressing their content, but that it's suppressing content that's not even classified as subversive. Like perhaps it's not that good at what it's doing. And certainly that can be the case. But I think from YouTube's perspective, it's a huge cost saver. Right now, they can fire all of those human moderators and they can just have this one AI managing all of their content moderation and having maybe a couple of interns who they say, well, here's a list of things to plug into the AI of what's allowed to be discussed and what's not. You know, let the AI make the decision. And I think that over time, their AI, if it is underperforming, if it is making poor decisions, they'll notice that and they'll improve the AI. And as we've seen with other AIs, their accuracy and the quality of their output has been steadily improving over time. None of the AIs can really compete with human subject matter experts per se today. Like maybe some of them are starting to compete at that level, but it really kind of depends on the subject. Like for example, in my field, I have yet to see any AI really compete with the best of human programmers, but they're starting to outperform, you know, juniors and maybe intermediates. So with something as simple as content moderation, the AI will probably do a good job. And I don't see big tech stepping away from that. I see them embracing it more and more and more because, you know, it's cheaper. That's the main reason.
Do you think it's an AI bubble that's going to burst?
No, I don't think that there's an AI bubble that's going to burst. And maybe it depends on what you mean by AI. There will certainly be a transition point from the current style of AI that and the current technologies that are being used to do AI to better, more advanced AI. But I don't see AI going away anytime soon. That genie has like left the bottle and it's really hard to put that back in. So we are now living in a world where we have to deal with these AIs and we are going to have to make wise decisions about how we handle that. And there's a lot of guidance already from the elders of the past who have put plenty of thought into this world that we're now living with robots and AIs and whatnot. And I highly recommend that any listeners who are interested in this subject go and read the classics by the greats like Isaac Asimov, Arthur C. Clarke, and various other science fiction from when all of these authors were actually game theorying this whole robot AI world out and all of the pitfalls that people could run into. I think it's actually important for people to not entirely reject AI and robots per se. Like, they can for sure if they want to. Like, I'm not saying that they have to use AI or they have to like AI. I'm just saying that it's not going anywhere. And if you're going to be interacting with these things, then what you really need is a positive vision. You need to be aware of the pitfalls, but it's not just about being aware of the pitfalls. You also have to have a positive vision for what kind of AI and robot future do you want? And that's where all of this media comes in, whether it's books or movies or TV shows. And a lot of the media that has come out of Hollywood when it comes to robots and AI, much of it, you know, perhaps the most famous one out of Hollywood that is honestly one of my favorites is Terminator, mm-hmm. Terminator 2. And that's all about, you know, DARPA and whatnot and like the defense contractors, like that's how they view AI and whatnot. They view it through this like killing machine kind of lens. And we need less of that. They're gonna say, no, we need more of that. We need to be better at it. But okay, whatever. You guys can have your point of view. I'm gonna have mine, okay? And that exists. That certainly exists, but we need less of that, and we need more people looking at like how these technologies can enhance people's lives as opposed to destroy their lives. And we have a lot of great examples to pick from in the media world, and I'll throw a few of them out. So Star Trek is one of the ones that I like to recommend to people, specifically Star Trek Voyager and Star Trek The Next Generation and also Deep Space Nine. Those three classic Star Treks give a positive vision to the future, not just to the ordinary person, but also to defense contractors as well, as to how these AI systems can be used to both help on the battlefield, but also help humans in terms of medicine and whatnot, and giving guidance and support for decision making. And the other reason that Star Trek is really important is because what made the show great is all of the ethical choices that the captains were constantly wrestling with. Mm-hmm. And that's really important if you're a defense contractor, right? Because you're making life or death decisions, and as well as for militaries, you know, that kind of media, I think, it offers a positive vision for the future. But then on a more down-to-earth level, from a day-to-day perspective, I think the Japanese have done a fantastic job of making lots of animes where they show how these robots can integrate into people's lives on a day-to-day basis and help with, like, you know, random things like chores around the house. And, you know, that I'm sure people would be grateful to not have to wash the dishes, right? Mm-hmm. So yeah. Something like that, very simple, can improve people's lives.
Yeah. I mean, I always think about that with AI, and I think there's real concerns about, like, AI is going to take my job and stuff like that, which is something that's happened as technology develops. Like, AI, you know, whatever the technology is, it fills a certain job, and it really does suck for you when you lose your job at that time. But I always wonder, it's like with constant improvement in technology, and especially with something like AI, which does have the ability to do so many like menial things that we have to do all the time, especially to manage our digital lives. It's kind of like, can we not just all have that time back for ourselves and let the AI, you know, do it so that we can chill and have more time to, I don't know, hang out in the garden or to do stuff like that? It's like, do they all need to be screenwriters?
Yeah, that, you know, I feel like that vision of like with more technology, we're going to have more free time. I feel like that idea has been with us for a long time. It's been with us for a while, and we've been getting more technology. And what it seems like is like, well, maybe sometimes we have more free time, but also other times it's almost like new jobs get invented that we didn't know were even jobs before. Like, you know, parents really probably have no business telling their kids what they should do with their lives, right? Mm-hmm. Because the worlds that the parents lived in were very different from today's generations. And the needs of today's generations are very different. And so the tasks that need to be completed are different, and therefore the jobs are different. And so I think that technology will improve. It'll make us more efficient, but it may not necessarily give us more free time. There'll always be something that's still that the AI can't do quite right, that will still kind of require, you know, a human touch to it. And even now, for whatever reason, we see that people are still really interested in, for example, in Magnus Carlsen's ventures. Like did he win or lose against this human or whatnot, right? They're invested in his journey. And they really pay attention to this stuff and they care about it. And Magnus Carlsen has managed to make a living off of this as well. So that old profession of just playing chess hasn't disappeared, mm-hmm. even though today your phone could beat him, right?
Yeah.
Chess, what he does. So that's, I think that's also something that we should acknowledge and see that as an interesting, valid point, that these technologies may not necessarily even replace things that we already currently do. They could augment it, they could help with it, but maybe just because of the fact that we're humans, we may find it interesting to simply interact with other humans.
Yes. Yeah. I know I do. I like humans. Although my friend always says that ChatGPT is her favorite coworker. Because she's like, ChatGPT always just there to you know, to do what I want it to. And I get that, you know, because... And I think that's part of the logic behind AI taking over so many things.
Yeah,
right?
We should probably talk a little bit about the privacy implications of that.
Okay, well, let's go for it.
When you're talking to an AI, you really need to remember to view it from the perspective of, I'm not just talking to this AI, I'm talking to a company,
mm-hmm.
right? So all of my conversations are being stored and logged, and they may be used for various different purposes. And some of those purposes could be against you, whether... in very obvious ways or in very subtle ways. And you don't really know how that's going to be used against you or for you. You know, I'm not necessarily saying it's all doom and gloom, but you just need to be aware that this isn't, that you're giving your, you know, you could, like your coworker could be giving very intimate details about her relationships with other people that she might not even necessarily have permission to divulge to this company, right? And remember, when you give information to a company, and whether it's a big tech company or not a big tech company, and they're not using end-to-end encryption, that information is kind of like, it's basically, you're revoking all rights to it, basically, is what's happening. Is that it's now, you can think of it as being in the hands of whoever, and mm-hmm. you don't know who that whoever is. It could go anywhere. It could be, once it gets into hackers' hands, it can go anywhere. So people need to be very much aware of when they're signing up for these AI services that's going to be the kind of relationship that they have with AI. So what I recommend is don't sign up for the AI services. Don't give them your name, your phone number. And if you give them your phone number, don't give them your actual phone number. Yeah. Some of them will require you to use a real phone number and not a VoIP number. If that's the case, I would say don't use that service at all, because there are many other services that you can use to access large language models in a more anonymous way. And there are many services and companies who are now popping up who offer as a feature more private. I wouldn't say completely private AI, because if you want completely private AI, the best way to do that is to download the large language model locally to your machine and run it yourself.
Mm-hmm.
And this is very easy to do. So there are lots of programs like LM Studio is one example that makes this really easy to do with all the latest models. If you have a fairly decent machine, you can download them at home and you can ask the AI to do whatever you want from the privacy of your home. Some of these models won't be as fast. They won't be as intelligent because they're slightly smaller models. If that's an issue for you, you could spend a few grand to get a beefier machine mm-hmm. That you just do AI stuff on if privacy is a really a big concern. And if that's not the road you want to take, then you can use other services that advertise themselves as taking steps to protect your privacy. So there are some services that, for example, will act as a middleman that will have less identity checks around them that will still connect to these other big companies and big providers of AI that you can then use. And then they can kind of like shield your identity a little bit. There are other services that allow you to use the LLMs completely free without an account. And you can use those as well. And then there are other companies, like I'll just name one company that I recall. Venice is a company that focuses on providing more private, privacy-protecting AI features to people. So,
wow, Greg, I'm thoroughly scared, but also kind of full of hope. So I love learning more about, you know, my digital life and what I could be doing better and the other options that are actually out there for me.
Well, thank you, John. I really enjoyed the conversation. You always ask excellent questions. So thank you.